I'm Henry St. John from the US Rate Strategy Team, and you're listening to At Any Rate, our global research podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industries and markets today. I'm joined today by Jay Barry, Josh Younger, and Brian Yee to talk about thematics for volatile fixed income markets. Okay, so I'm joined by the head of US government bond strategy, Jay Barry. Jay, so just to begin with, so far, given the extent of the rally that we've had over the last 2 weeks or so, how much do you think of this as a repricing in fundamentals versus technical drivers?
Hey, Henry. Thanks so much. Well, I think part of it is fundamental in nature, because if we look at how the virus has begun to spread beyond China and beyond Italy over the course of the past couple of weeks, there's a clear concern about what it will mean for growth. And we see that the market, after the Fed eased aggressively last week with a 50 basis point intermediate ease, the market's taken that to say that the Fed will probably ease aggressively further. And we look at the other instances in where the Fed has eased intermediate, it has followed up that intermediate ease with another aggressive ease at the next meeting. Similarly, the closer we get to the lower bound, the more likely it is that the Fed is going to use its remaining bullets quite aggressively rather than judiciously. And that's what was done in late 2008 in the final move down to zero. Our own forecast is now calling for the Fed to ease by 100 basis points sometime between now and the meeting next week. So clearly the markets and the OIS markets are pricing that in, and that's justified the move to lower rates. Beyond that, we've seen market-based inflation expectations drop quite precipitously as well. And they're very close to the lowest levels we've seen since the crisis. To the extent that the Fed is very focused on anchoring inflation expectations to be more credible in its inflation target, that drop has sort of also justified the move lower in long-term rates as well. So a lot of this is justified, but when we look at the moves, you know, where we are right now, after adjusting for how the market's pricing the Fed, inflation, and growth, and the stance of policy globally, it appears that 10-year yields are trading with about a premium of 25 to 30 basis points. So we're 25 to 30 basis points below where we should be. There's a pretty fair dislocation there.
So you've noted in some of your research that positioning across the various metrics looks a lot more neutral than it did a little while ago. To what extent do you think the sort of neutral positioning plays out for treasuries in the next few weeks?
Yeah, I think that was also a part of the rally and part about what's driven the dislocation. We began the year with many investors comparing 2020 to 1999 or 1995 or even 1987-88, where after the Fed took out insurance eases, once those were done, rates moved higher as the Fed went back on hold. So the resting positions were quite short. And we look at the aggregate of our Treasury client survey and the CFTC data on speculative positioning interest rate futures. The average of those two were about 2+ standard deviations short as recently as the beginning of February. Now the aggregate of those two measures are within a half a standard deviation of flat, but they're not long. So while it's unlikely that short covering will drive a further rally like we have seen over the course of the past 4 weeks or so, and really over the last two, it doesn't tell me that investor positioning is aggressively long at this point. And it's not something that tells me that we're at the point where we should think about the premium that's been built up in intermediate treasuries dissipating anytime soon.
So we saw obviously a concerted steepening as the front end sort of moved lower initially, pricing in the Fed action. If we continue to approach the zero lower bound at the front end, how do you expect the curve starts to trade from that point on?
Yeah, I think we've got a playbook from what happened the last time the Fed went to zero in 2008. And if we look at the year leading up to the cut to zero on December 15th of 2008, the Treasury yield curve tended to trade it counter-directionally, with the curve flattening as interest rates rose and steepening as interest rates declined. But as we got to the lower bound, that directionality shifted in the opposite direction. As the front end of the yield curve was pinned, and this was really strongest in, call it, twos, tens more so than anywhere else, we saw the yield curve start to flatten as yields declined and steepen as yields rose. So we're kind of seeing that dynamic right now. The market's pricing in some likelihood the Fed will be going back to zero in the next couple of months. And with limited room for front-end yields to decline, we're seeing the curve display this sort of positive directionality. And we'd expect that to continue going forward. We think it's going to be sort of most concentrated again, at the front end. So curves like twos, tens are likely to be highly directional with what intermediate yields do. Whereas at the long end, we've observed the same phenomenon as well, although it is somewhat looser, but we would expect the same thing to hold true, seeing the back end of the curve flatten as yields decline and steepen out as yields rise. So the behavior of the market over the course of the past week, you know, it's been a strong evolution from considering an intermediate cut to thinking about the zero lower bound, but it's certainly sort of behaving as if we're on that track.
So you've also been pointing in your research towards the dispersion between off the runs and on the run treasury securities across the curve that's really risen, spiked quite significantly over the last couple of sessions. What are we to make of that dispersion?
I think we know from a macro perspective that liquidity is impaired, and we spent a lot of time talking about the deterioration in market depth that's occurred as volatility has increased. And that's sort of natural in what we've seen evolve over the course of the past few years. But as that's occurred, we've also started to see a preference for liquidity open up. So on an aggregate basis, we look at the aggregate dispersion of all treasuries along our curve relative to our par curve model. And in that measure, we've seen the aggregate dispersion of the curve increase by about a basis point and a half over the course of the past week, getting closer to the upper end of the range that we've seen over the last 5 years. So there are more dislocations appearing. And we also see this on a micro scale. If we look at relationships in between liquid on the runs and less liquid off the runs, those spreads have moved sharply. Just for example, we look at the spread between the current 10-year and the triple old 10-year, a 10-year which was issued really just at the early part of 2019. The spread between those securities on an asset swap basis has moved out about 6 basis points over the course of the past week, indicating that on the runs are trading 6 basis points richer relative to the swap curve, relative to their off the run counterparts. That's a pretty large move. And after adjusting for the recent volatility in that spread, it's on par with what we saw in late 2008. So there's a clear preference to own on the run securities, which trade more actively, which are less financing intensive, whereas the less liquid, more financing intensive off the runs are trading at a pretty steep discount. So all else equal, you know, we're at the point where off the runs are looking quite cheap along the curve, but with volatility remaining relatively high, risk aversion remaining relatively high as well, we don't know what the impetus is to think that these off the runs will start to trade a bit better on the curve.
So just finally turning to the tips market, we've seen break evens obviously taking a fair hit alongside oil prices. Firstly, how far below zero do we think that real yields can travel, particularly at the long end? And as well as that, how suitable do we think the energy price shocks of 2015 are as a comparison point for what's going to happen to real yields and tips this time around?
Yeah, thanks for that. So looking at tips and the way our forecasts have worked out, you know, a lot of how we'll forecast tips break evens are based off of movements in oil, movements in the dollar, movement in risk appetite in the form of credit spreads. And when we take those into account and we look at where real yields can head, we think there's a distinct possibility that you could see intermediate real yields in the 10-year sector fall as low as negative 65 basis points in the middle of the year, and real yields at the long end of the curve fall as much as into negative 30 basis point area or so. So certainly, given the change in our forecast for energy prices, given what's occurred over the course of the past few days in the energy markets and what's happening in risk assets as well, it indicates that there's room for real yields to decline further from current levels. And it probably means that tips break evens there's likely to remain pressure on them. If we look at what happened in 2015 and 2016, the front end of the inflation curve narrowed pretty sharply as oil prices moved lower and made rapid declines during that period. And that makes sense to us because energy is one of the large components of the CPI basket. So when energy prices decline, tips carry deteriorates, and that's most aggressively felt at the front end of the curve. And indeed, what we have seen here is that it's been the very short end that's been hit the most. So one-year inflation swaps retraced to levels very close to record lows. And we've seen the same thing happen in sort of the forward space as well. So we're quite sensitive at the front end with what's happened to energy prices. And we do think that the short end of the tips curve looks cheap relative to its drivers. But against the backdrop of what's happening in energy and what's happening with respect to risk appetite, we don't think that those are going to sort of bounce back anytime soon. Although we do think in the second half of the year, if we're right, and the concerns over the virus fades, domestic growth returns back above trend, we do think there's room for break-evens to widen back, albeit still to levels that were much narrower than persisted even just a few weeks ago.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Jay.
Thanks, Henry.
Okay, so now I'm joined by the head of US interest rate derivative strategy, Josh Younger. Josh, just to begin with, what's going on with FRAOAS? Are we looking at the early stages of a bank funding crisis, or is it something less sinister than that?
Yeah, so FRAOAS was at the epicenter of everything that happened in 2008. So whenever you get one of these impulsive widenings, the tendency is to say, what is it? What is it telling us? And the evidence is that there's not nearly as much stress in credit markets as you would infer from where FRAOAS is trading. And certainly not over the time period during which FRAOAS has widened. So the question becomes, like, what's driving it wider, if not bank funding concerns? And something I think is important to keep in mind is that LIBOR has had relatively little to do with credit for quite some time. So when we look at LIBOR quotes, the individual panelists, the quotes they submit, you would imagine that the highest quote is from the widest credit spread. And it turns out that that's not generally the case. In fact, the correlation between the rank order of quotes and the rank order of CDS spreads, they're not very well correlated. They have very little to do with each other. So these incremental credit events, like when credit spreads widen, even what we would these days say is a lot, as long as you're not on the tails of a real bank funding crisis, it really shouldn't show up in LIBOR. So what you're really seeing is a mechanical exercise, which is rates go lower and OIS is leading that rally. That's been the case actually for several months. We just haven't declined so much in rate. But when that happens, because the OIS leads and LIBOR lags, the segmentation between the CP and the unsecured funding markets and OIS Fed funds expectations means that you're going to get a mechanical widening in that basis.
Okay, so an interesting characteristic of the rally of the last week or so is that futures have led the way lower. And we've seen obviously a lot of volatility in the cash futures basis over the last few days. Why do you think it is that futures are leading the rally?
Yeah, so it's a couple of things. The first is, important to keep in mind that the fundamentals say futures should be cheapening in this rally, especially in the long end. So the post-close volatility, the tendency for rates to move after the close of pit trading, when the invoice price on the futures is set, that volatility imparts a lot of optionality to the contract, to the short leg of the contract. So by selling the contract, you've bought this wildcard option. It's worth quite a bit more when rates are volatile than when they're stable. So volatility is clearly up. And that means that the futures should actually be cheapening. The reason why they're richening is very flow driven. So on the one hand, you have very severe liquidity tiering among products. So rates are going down. The thing that's going to go down the most is the thing that's most liquid. That's generally the futures market. So you get futures leading cash, leading swaps. And that's why swap spreads have widened for the most part in this rally. And so that explains part of it. The other part, which is more recent, we think has to do with operational risk management, which is there's this concern growing as people increasingly work from home and split locations on the street. As you're mass relocating the dealer complex to different locations over a relatively short period of time, operationally intensive, low P&L trades start to look a lot less attractive. And treasury basis is a great example of that, which is the upside is fairly limited. So it's the downside. But in many cases, those were overnight funded or they had to get rolled with high frequency. And so if operational risk rather than market risk is dominating your framework, that's not a particularly attractive trade to have on. That would lead to a cheapening of the basis, a richening of futures relative to the cash. So there's probably some of that going on as well.
So as you alluded to before, we've seen swap spreads. They widened out late last week. We've seen them mostly come in a little bit since then. The question is, how do we think about swap spreads from here? Do we start to think that convexity hedging takes a more dominant role from here?
Yeah, so convexity hedging, specifically we're referring to mortgage hedgers and bank hedgers, and all of them are short duration. So they have to add that duration back. They can do it with a number of different products, but there's a lot of reasons why they would prefer to do so in swap, particularly, frankly, with spreads at these levels. So that receiving hasn't come through yet. Part of that, I think, is related to the liquidity tiering that I alluded to before. Part of it simply how quickly rates have rallied. But ultimately, it's very hard to sit short the market when rates are rallying by 50s and hundreds of basis points. And so we think those flows are coming. They just haven't quite arrived yet. So on the flow-driven side, the convexity hedging is a receive fixed flow, and that should narrow swap spreads. And then on the more sort of fundamental side, on the one hand, you have a deficit expectation that's probably too low. Like the CBO is very self-reflective on these things, and they've told us that they're usually off by 2% of GDP if there's a recession. So to the extent that recession risks are rising, that should be quite bearish for spreads. And then there's some more sort of operational issues associated with how the front end of the curve is managed by the Fed. But a lot of that points to a bias higher in IOER to manage a potential decline in Fed funds, and that should push GC higher relative to other rates. That should cheapen spreads as well. So there are a number of arguments. One's flow-driven convexity, and the others are fundamental, meaning the deficit expectation and the dynamics at the front end. All of those things point to narrower spreads.
Okay, and then just finally, turning to vol markets, have we finally reached log normality? And why is it the vol has been so bid as we've moved lower towards the zero lower bound?
Yeah, so let's define log normality first. What does that mean? It means we're near a barrier. So if we presume that there's a level below which rates cannot go, and that's typically been zero, then a high level of implied volatility close to that barrier implies a very high probability of being below that barrier. And fundamentally, if we don't think that's reasonable, you have to start truncating the distribution effectively. You have to cut off those tails. Log normal distribution does that for you. So it's sort of shorthand for a truncated distribution. And as we get towards zero, that means that vols have to compress because otherwise that distribution goes too far through zero. So we saw that back in 2012 when rates were at low levels, at least in the front end. We think we're kind of there, not just if you assume there's no probability of going below zero, but also if you assume up to 10 or 20% probability that you go below zero. So even if you allow for a lot of so-called leakage to negative policy rates, and in this case, actually negative LIBOR, because there's swaptions, so very negative policy rates, you still have a world where the distribution is starting to get truncated. We think fundamentally rates down, vol should come down as well. You're seeing a little bit of that at the upper left of the vol grid in short underlying maturities. The question is why this hasn't been more aggressively so, and there we have the counterpoint, which is there's been increasing frequency or at least a number of microstructure breakdowns, basically flash rallies of the kind that we saw in 2014, not necessarily of the same magnitude, although not that far off either. And to the extent that market makers are intraday delta hedgers, like the street who's intermediating and pricing this risk is very sensitive to intraday moves. When those intraday moves are very large compared to the close-to-close moves, you can have vol trading at levels that you would otherwise say are relatively unrealistic. So this is one of those times, basically. And you get an artificial, or I don't know if you'd call it artificial, but you get a bid for vol simply from the fact that markets are so disorderly over the course of the trading session.
Great. Thanks very much, Josh. Okay, so now I'm joined with Brian Yee, head of agency MBS research. So Brian, I guess first question, how much have mortgages widened? And also, you know, what's driving this move?
Thank you. Yes. We have widened quite a bit. Just over the past 2 weeks, looks like we are 30 basis points wider. This is measured in terms of Treasury OAS on the entire mortgage index. I think the sell-off really, or the widening really, sped up over the last week or so as the 10-year benchmark yield dipped below 1%, stayed there. I think at one point got as low as like sub 40 basis points. And stresses are clearly showing in our space. I think trading volume is up about 50% over the past month or so. And if you look at the spreads right now, Treasury OAS of 80 basis points, nominal spread to the 5-10 blend is somewhere around 150, 160 at this point. We are still underperforming this day. If you look at spread level going back 10, 15 years outside of the 2008 financial crisis height, which we went to about 180, this doesn't quite feel like that, but 80 basis points, pretty much we are at the wides that we saw during the 2010 refinancing wave and again during the 2012 refinancing wave. So it is a refinancing sort of driven, convexity driven spread widening. And one way that we like to look at MBS, if you look at the spread that we offer per the unit duration on these instruments. Mind you, our production coupon Fannie 2.5 is roughly a 2-year duration now, very, very short. And if you look at this ratio of spread to duration, we're talking about 80 basis points per unit of spread of duration or per unit of duration. If you look at other spread products, we've seen high-grade corporates widening out as well to somewhere around 200, 230 basis points. I don't know where they are right at this moment, but they are a 8-year duration instrument.
Okay, great. And just looking forward, you know, what do you see as the major headwinds to the market, you know, if rates remain low and sort of higher regime of vol remains entrenched for a while longer?
Yeah. So vol is certainly a very major issue for us. You know, the convexity is what we have to deal with. And if you have vols, you know, staying high, and that makes it very hard to realize the carry. But I think mortgages typically do well when vol is low. Most of us know this. And another headwind that we are dealing with, obviously, is a refi wave. With the refi wave, which we just got one more print. This measures the activity that took place last week. The refinancing demand went up by 50% week over week. So that was a quite caught a lot of people's attention. So interestingly, this particular reading is generally in line with what we had in the 2012-2013 waves, and close to what we had during the 2010 refi wave as well. So when the refi demand is so high, there is greater uncertainty with respect to where your cash flow is going to look like 2-3 months out. So remember, all the applications that are submitted now is going to be realized in 2-3 months time, which also means when originators see the refi demand in, what they do is they will first sell into the futures market, which in our case, the TBA market, that's happening right now. And so what we fully expect that the realized gross supply in 2-3 month time is going to go up from about, I would say, $150 billion a month gross to well over $200 billion per month. And these sales are happening right now. That is why the market is under a lot of stress, you know, over the past few days. And another sort of headwinds is not only is the gross supply going up, also the net supply is also going to be increasing as we head into the purchase heavy season of April, May, and for the rest of the rest of summer. So supply headwinds is going to be with us for quite some time, especially if the rates stay this low. Now, just final point is the supply is, or the prepayments are going to be so high that we, even without Fed doing changing any of its policies, the Fed's MBS SOMA portfolio's runoff is going to go up from about $21 billion a month recently, $23 billion a month recently, to they could hit $40 billion a month, of which anything over 20, they're going to have to reinvest into the MBS. Now, there is a possibility that Fed might change its policy, change how it reinvests its mortgage pay downs. That is not necessarily our baseline forecast. Should it tweaks any of the policy there, that will give a boost to our sector, certainly.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for more episodes of, at any rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan Research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2020, JP Morgan Chase & Co. All rights reserved. This episode was recorded on March 11th, 2020.